and welcome to Happy Place, the show that asks you to forget what's happening out there and concentrate just for a little bit on what's going on in here. I'm pointing at my head. I'm Fern Cotton, and today we're talking to artist and Britain's most celebrated portrait artist, Jonathan Yeo.
When someone looks at you, it actually slows down your cognitive processes. You actually are less able to think about other things. And you can see how that must have happened in an evolutionary way, because if you're out in the sort of savannas or the kind of like in the wilds or in this like potentially hostile world, then someone suddenly being aware of your presence meant you had to make a decision whether it was okay to stick around or do a runner.
Even if the last time you held a paintbrush was in school, do not fret. Jonathan has a brilliant way of getting inside your mind. And if you're unfamiliar with his work, please, please go and have a quick look. There's some links in the show notes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Now, though, here's the show. Thank you so much for saying yes to coming on the podcast. This is a treat.
It's an honour. Thank you, Fern.
I've probably looked at you on a screen more than any other human during lockdown, because we've been doing our portrait sessions, which for me is like the biggest honour, because as you know, I'm a huge fan of your work. So to get painted by you is just like mind-blowing every time. So we've been doing this lovely sort of Zoom series where we're talking to each other from our respective homes on screens, and you're painting me. How are you finding this? Because I'm, you know, one in a long line of people that you're painting now. How's that process been for you?
It's interesting. And obviously these things are, this came up because of necessity in some ways, but it's something I'd slightly wondered about before, because obviously in my day job, I'm used to getting people to come and sit for me in the studio. And I guess I've always convinced myself over the years that that's better, because the alternative was to take photos of people. And photos obviously don't move. They're one-eyed viewpoint, and they're static, and they don't show the personality. You don't get to see how people react and move to things. You don't see the three-dimensionality of someone's face, and you can't change the lighting as you want as you go along. And actually, what I found is that because of the sort of, you know, technology of recent years, i.e. sort of FaceTime and Skype and that kind of thing, and being able to see people while you're talking to them remotely, some of those problems are overcome by that. It does still present some other problems, which is that, you know, you have the limitations anyway of the kind of video calling, and the fact that it's fairly low bandwidth and you don't get to really see the detail and the shadows and that kind of thing. The main thing is you don't really see the shape of someone's face. Then I slightly lean on what I assume and what I remember from when I've seen people. So I've been lucky in a way so far that I've been painting people I knew already, although I'm definitely finding it easier with the people I've spent a lot of time with in the past rather than less so. But it's a really interesting thing. It's definitely it's producing a slightly different kind of portrait, but they're not actually necessarily less good. They're just different.
I mean, I cannot wait to see the end result of mine. We're sort of, what would you say, over halfway now?
Yeah. I think I feel like this sort of, I mean, I feel it's like a nice painting, and it's definitely partly you, and it's like all the other. I guess these things are a bit more like snapshots than complete, or little interviews than complete biographies, which I feel that portraits usually are if you spend a lot of time on them.
That's interesting.
But so I don't know whether you'll feel it's a recognizable one or whether it's sort of completely representative. I think certainly it captures something, and it's quite fun in a way that, you know, I guess I haven't had the sort of usual excuse of being able to work on something as long as I need to, because it forces you to do things a little bit more instinctively.
So that's interesting. So when you have a live sitting and you've got someone there and you're painting them for hours, days, however long it might take, is your end goal to create an image of them that does feel biographical, that you get the whole of them, the complete story of who they are? Is that part of what you're aiming for?
It's a very good question. This is getting into the kind of philosophy of what a portrait is. I think certainly that's in your mind what your aim is. You know, arguably, a portrait, inevitably, especially a painted portrait, is as much a document of that relationship as a full biography, because you only know what you've seen of someone. But you definitely get a bit more having spent time with them. A photograph is absolutely what was happening at that moment in that field of view. But that's all it is. Whereas, you know, a portrait it is made over time. You're painting different parts of the picture literally at different times of the day, and maybe sometimes on different days. They might be in different moods. You might be in a different mood. You know, if someone's kind of had a great night's sleep and they're feeling positive about life, they'll look different. They've just flown in from somewhere, or have been up all night because of the kids, or having a bad day at work, or in their relationship or something. And so the advantage you've got with a portrait is you do it over a bit of time. In my case, over several sittings, sometimes, you know, a dozen sittings, but over several months. And so bit by bit, you piece together the sort of jigsaw, which is ideally a bit wider than you'd see if you just saw them once. And the judgment, I guess, is in knowing how much to bring in of the different elements. You don't want to show people just having a great time, but you certainly don't want to have them, you know, focus too much if they were having one or two bad days and that wasn't necessarily representative of their life overall.
I find it fascinating. I mean, because, you know, I like to paint, but it's on a very amateur, kind of for fun at home level. And I still strive just for likeness, really. And I think that, of course, all good portraits do capture an essence of what you're talking about there, you know, getting that mood or their story or what the narrative around that time in their life has been like. And I think that people are perhaps not as capable of picking up those sort of perhaps nuanced facial expressions or feelings that are afoot these days. And maybe that's, well, obviously you're trained in that area because of your job, but maybe because we're looking at screens so much, we have diluted our own ability to read people in that way. Do you think that's true?
That's interesting. I think maybe you're right that we are. Everything's quite fast and edited and sampled, and we don't necessarily spend as long reading the little subtle expressions and micro expressions. I think we are pretty hardwired to do it as animals, and therefore we do pick these things up. I think an example is that when we've all seen films or seen computer games where human faces, sometimes ones we're supposed to know, are being shown, and there's always something that feels a bit wrong. Whereas, you know, VFX and graphics can do so many effects so convincingly and wonderfully, and yet somehow the human part of it always feels a bit wrong. And that's not because they spend less effort on those. Sometimes they spend more. I think it's just the fact we are so, because it's important for our survival, to know if there's something a bit wrong, a bit fake, or unreal or unnatural about what you're looking at when it's another human being. It's deep in us. And so I think there's a bit of both, perhaps.
This might sound a bit out there, but I can certainly, I mean, there are similarities in what we do, I guess, because when I'm interviewing someone, much more so in the flesh, you will feel a certain energy, and it's nothing to do with their facial expression necessarily or even what they're saying, but it's just a bit of a vibe. And it could be a wonderful, you know, experience, or you might just feel like, gosh, it's a standoffish vibe. There's an energy there. We can certainly all experience that with people we live with, people that we know inside out, or family members that we might visit a lot. You know, when there's that weird energy or vibe and something's going on with them, but they're not willing to show anything. I wonder if you ever look to pick that up, or if you do pick it up, and if you implement that and you use that for what you're creating.
Are you absolutely right that that's a very palpable thing? If I'm honest, I would say I don't look for it. And when it happens, it's not something you're conscious of often until afterwards, that you've just picked up on it and channeled it, because you're trying to basically translate what you're looking at onto the canvas. And I think there's, it's also wrapped up in some other things. One of the things I find when I'm painting often is I can get really stuck on a part. I think, well, there's something wrong with the mouth, say. And it's only when I've like changed it five times and it still hasn't got any better that I start working on something else on the face or something in the way they're sitting or standing. And suddenly it all looks fine. And I think we do connect lots of things in our brain without knowing it. And obviously that what mood someone's in, whether they're feeling boisterous or retiring or confident or shy, often comes from the way they're standing, the way their bones are hanging, and whether the head is in relation to their shoulders and all that kind of thing. But we maybe identify it with a particular expression that we recognise as well, and so put the emphasis on that. So it's a bit more of a holistic thing, I think, because you know, we are physical creatures. Every part of us, you know, when you're really animated, every part of you is moving.
I really want to kind of get stuck into your story, because we've been chatting a lot when we've been doing these sittings, but it's probably been more about me yabbing on about my stuff and what I'm doing. And I'm so fascinated in how you got to where you are, because to become one of the most renowned and respected portrait artists is no mean feat. I mean, the art world is notoriously hard to get recognition in. You know, it's almost impossible, I think, if you went to a careers advisor or whatever and said, I want to be an artist, they would sort of laugh, because it is just one of those almost sort of impossible feats. So if we go right back to the start, so you went to an academic school in London, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you didn't necessarily feel like you were excelling in the areas that you were being pushed in there.
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, also, this was, you know, in the 80s, so we were, it was quite structured. There was this assumption that you did sort of like the standard subjects and you had to do them in the prescribed way very well. And the arts and other things were a bit of an add-on and were seen as hobbies, certainly not as careers. And I had no one in the family who was in the art world or anything remotely like it. So it was certainly something which didn't occur to me till I was doing it, really, that it might be a career. I just kept doing it because I enjoyed it. And I was ended up trying to make a living as an artist after I left school, failed miserably, and ended up going and slightly under duress with my parents, studying English and film studies at university for a while. But I just carried on painting. I loved doing it, but it certainly was a frustration and a worry that I didn't think it was a possible career. So I was trying to get in as much as possible before I had to go and get a proper job.
But isn't it still seen as that today somewhat? Like, I always feel like I felt the same at school. I wasn't great at anything, but I loved painting. But it always felt like, oh well, that's fun, well done, that's a bit of fun for you. But it's not something that is perhaps given the amount of energy and attention that I think it deserves, because certainly as an adult and now as a parent, I can see the benefits of art and on a really integral emotional level for my kids to express themselves. I think that's more important than doing maths, quite frankly, because especially for my son, who's a really intense character, and he often has trouble expressing what he's feeling and these night terrors that he's having. But if I give him some paper and some pens, he just pours all this stuff out. And I do feel that, you know, we need to move on from that slightly. It feels like quite an archaic way of thinking about quite an important life skill, perhaps.
I feel like it has moved a bit, but quite slowly. I think you hit about something interesting there as well, which is that, and I was pretty lucky early on, I managed to sort of like just make a living in those early years when most people give up because it's so hard. And part of that's because I found doing portraits relatively easy, and there was always just enough. There's always someone who wanted me to paint them, and so I could keep it going until I had a bit more freedom to explore other things. And obviously now most things are still face related in some way, but obviously quite broad. But the fact is, I mean, I think everyone thinks that, you know, and I still get lots of people, including friends and family, sort of who I think make the assumption that life is just this, like wafting into the studio and doing a bit of painting for as long as I feel like it and going home and everything's great. The reality is that, you know, on a good week for me is when I probably spend 3 days of the week painting, and on a bad week, I maybe only one, because actually, you know, part of the whole thing is, obviously you still have to think about making a living and, you know, running a little business, which is effectively what it is. But, you know, what you are expected, you do exhibitions because that's how you get the work out there. You have to do books. You end up doing interviews, and you have endless meetings about all kinds of things which might or might not happen. And when they do happen, take a lot of time to organise. And, you know, the very, very few artists have a whole infrastructure of people who can do that entirely for them. And therefore, actually, when I think about it, I try not to. But if it was my hobby and I didn't have a very busy day job, I might be spending almost as much time actually painting as I am when it is my job. And so I guess it slightly depends what you're doing it for. I think, you know, a lot of people, I mean, like to do it because it makes them happy. And as you say, it's a way of, you know, thinking things through and investigating things and reflecting on things. And actually, you don't need to necessarily have the kind of, you know, be anointed as a sort of, you know, professional artist or whatever it is people think it is in order to do that and actually to really get a lot out of it.
Absolutely. I mean, going off piece slightly, but I came up with this charity initiative for the Prince's Trust last year, like a Happy Place charity initiative based around art and creativity, because it was something that they were trialling anyway, especially for young people that had experienced, you know, trauma and really dark times. And I sat in on a couple of these art therapy sessions ahead of us launching this initiative, which is called The Great Create. And it was powerful. Like, you know, I kind of vented my own troubles or whatever through the process. But to see a bunch of young people who really didn't know each other very well sit and perhaps weren't able to articulate or didn't feel comfortable talking, to see them sort of sit and pour out whatever feelings or whatever it was onto the page was quite extraordinary. And again, perhaps art needs to be reframed at school so it is used as more of a therapeutic thing rather than you're good at this or you're bad at this. I don't know.
It's a very good idea. I mean, it always puzzles me how you can really sort of score art at the A level or even GCSE level when actually the sort of, I think, the skills which are supposed to be valuable then actually are less so if you do it more seriously later on. You know, being able to sort of like do standard things in a kind of recognisable way is valued early on, but actually, as you know, the more you do it, certainly if you're doing it professionally, actually doing things differently from everyone else is more valuable. And so encouraging people to sort of like make mistakes and get things wrong, I find that I'm endlessly doing it, whether it's because I'm showing my own kids how to do it or other people. And especially, I think portraiture is a good example of that, because obviously on one level, you don't want it to look completely unlike the person you're drawing. But at the same time, I think if you get too hung up on it has to be a photographic representation of someone, you miss something more important, which is an interpretation of who they are shown in some other, possibly much more imaginative way.
And perhaps also your enjoyment and experience of doing it, because if you're so uptight about, and I get like this, you know, it has to be perfect and it has to look a certain way, that element of enjoyment goes. And you know, my dad's a really brilliant painter. He was a sign writer for years and years, and now he paints for fun, now he's retired. And my mum's kind of jumped in on it for you know, purely therapeutic reasons, really. So every Friday they paint all afternoon. And my mum has kind of already established a really cool style and she's just enjoying it. And I think that's what needs to be encouraged more for sure, that people just give it a try, especially, you know, this is why it's lovely to have this chat now during this strange time we're going through and everybody kind of being robbed of what we would usually do for fun. People are getting the paints out for the first time and they are giving it a go for the first time. And it's, I feel like art has sort of accelerated in that way because everyone's just trying it. And that's such a joyful thing.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So look, going back to your story and you being at university, as you said, there sort of under duress, you started studying film and English, and then you had a really tough time and you got very sick.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I had Hodgkin's disease, which is a lymphoma, so lymphatic cancer. Although, I mean, I think if I'd got it 30 years earlier, it would have been really bad. By the time I got it, it was like, I think, 85% curable. So it was still a year of treatment to go through. At that time, it was, well, you're right, it was that time when I was 22 when I had it. So in a funny way, in retrospect, I actually get more and more thankful for it from the point of view that I was definitely at that point about to make a decision about what sensible job I could do because I wasn't going to do the thing I wanted to do. And it made me so pig-headed and determined to do what I wanted to do that and also at the same time, in a way, I think it made other people were so worried about giving me bad news that they didn't want to tell me I was rubbish or that I shouldn't be doing something as ridiculous as trying to make a living as an artist. So it bought me a year or two of determination and sort of leeway to sort of like have a crack at it, which is quite, anyone who's tried it will know that those first few years are so crucial because there's so many things stacked against you. So there's that. And I think another thing which I realized later in life, which I think something we touched on before, is that I definitely had ADD when I was at school, although it wasn't diagnosed until about 5 or 10 years ago, because it didn't exist then effectively. Certainly in this country there was very little recognition of it, and in retrospect, you know, I was sent to psychologists, everything, because of all the sort of problems with sort of like disturbing classes and all that sort of thing. And it was put down as being, you know, either you're unable to sort of discipline yourself or whatever it is. But it's an interesting thing. I've sort of pieced together so much of what I did well and badly over the years, and it does seem to relate to that. And I also see that, as far as I can tell, a lot of other of the most creative people that I've come in contact with over the years seem to have very similar kind of symptoms, as it were. And so this interesting thing there, it definitely does make some aspects of your life more difficult. The fact that you can't basically choose what to focus on a lot of the time. But it also has huge advantages from a creative point of view, because actually when you are interested in something, you find it's the opposite of what it sounds like. It's very easy to focus on it to the point that you can spend many hours, maybe, you know, kind of like 10, 15 hours doing something and being unaware of time passing and really, really sort of dig into it. Yeah, otherwise you might be sort of like pulled onto other things which you know are more urgent. So one of the things about it is you slightly kind of have this warped sense of what you're supposed to be doing and what's urgent, and that is can cause problems in other areas of life. But it's very useful for getting for like creative investigation and really sticking at something.
Yeah, because in your line of work, patience is the key, I guess. You know, you can't be haphazard about things or rush through things. You need to have that absolute laser point focus on what you're doing. And like you say, it could be for a whole day that you're in that headspace. So it's interesting that you found a way to channel that in a positive way. How do your symptoms manifest today? And how did they at school, and you know, were they dealt with appropriately in any sense? Because as you say, you know, these any sort of mental health discussion we have today was not happening when we were kids. And that's why I think we're all so determined to have this open conversation now, so that younger generations can experience hopefully a smoother ride, or at least feel comfortable talking about things.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, it certainly wasn't dealt with at all then. I mean, this is the late 80s, so you know, even dyslexia was a slightly kind of weird and out there concept, and a lot of people didn't really fully trust that it was a sort of thing. And I think increasingly we were learning that these things the question whether they're disorders even. I think that they're like just like different, we're all wired in slightly different ways, and education traditionally suited some people very well and not others, and therefore I think certainly it's something which, in terms of how it manifests now, I mean, you know, I lose things a lot. I still, like I say, I think it's sort of, you have this. It's a funny thing, because it is, yes, you can get distracted, but only if it's on some things when you're not. You haven't sort of like created the sort of focus for it. It's very hard. So, okay, well, the classic thing is, it's very hard. I find it impossible to revise for exams. No, I think they've actually done scientific sort of studies in terms of brain scans, scans of brain activity of people with it, without it. And what happens is, I think it's the frontal cortex, which is the one of the jobs is to, when something's urgent or important or, you know, almost dangerous or risky, then for most people that becomes more active. And so they can, you know, solve the sort of urgent problem, whatever it is. When you've got ADD, it does the opposite. It shuts down and you are actually less able to do whatever the thing is that's urgent. And it's one of those extraordinary things. Now, there are ways, I think more and more now they're learning that there are ways you can train yourself. You know, meditation's very good, various things. There's obviously been medication for years. I take that sometimes. And when you know I have to concentrate on something. And just knowing that it's a problem and how it manifests itself, I think that understanding more than anything else for me was just a huge eye-opener and makes you just able to kind of create mechanisms for coping with it. So knowing something is a problem because of you, not because you're just doing something wrong, and therefore how it might be a problem if you don't follow the little route you've worked out to fix it. That more than anything else is I think the most useful thing.
And as well as you being able to understand the difficulties you may have and actually channel them positively into painting, does painting actually help with it? Does it actually, you know, help you outside of that space? Does it give you perhaps some peace that you wouldn't have if you didn't paint?
Yes, I mean, I think both, really. I think it helps because it's actually, it is a job that is suited to that. I think a lot of creative things, from writing, music, to craft of all kinds, are suited to that, making things, effectively. But I think also painting, I don't know how related it is fundamentally. I think that I probably would enjoy painting no matter what, because I love the activity. I love seeing something evolve and have actually, you know, you've got something done over time is a wonderful thing. Whether I'd be sort of like any less happy doing something else, I don't know. I can totally see this. I'm very bad at making music and all kinds of other things, but I love doing that as well. I think that sort of, it is that satisfaction of starting something and not really knowing where it's going to end up, you know. And I definitely, what seems to happen is this advantage of having done something for years is you sort of convince yourself you've kind of nailed it and you've got a process for it. And almost always the best things come when you end up doing something different from what you planned, or just do it on autopilot. You know, if you're not really actually sort of overthinking what you're doing, but just allowing yourself to go into it, not thinking about totally other things either, but just sort of, I guess there's that, you know, people talk about it in different ways, sort of being in the zone or, you know, in the flow or, you know. But I think certainly that there's something about the act of just naturally being involved in an activity of making something where you're not consciously making decisions all the time.
Yeah, it's meditative, isn't it? It's that sense of escapism from thought. You know, I get that on my tiny level of you know, having a hobby of painting. I can sense that if I get into that flow. It's a really lovely space, very free space to be in. Going back to when you were at that sort of crossroads where you could have been looking for your sensible job, then you fell ill, and actually you then had that determination that, oh no, this is what I want to do. I wonder what your feelings are about if we are actually all capable of our biggest dreams. We reach a point of this in life where we go, I really want to do this. And I have a bit of self-belief, but maybe not enough self-belief, so I'll go down the slightly safer route. Do you think that we're all capable of doing what we really, really are dreaming of?
I think very few artists would ever say that they are so confident about what they're doing that they don't have any worries about it. I constantly have doubt. And often, you know, the best work is the work I almost scrap halfway through. I'm so convinced it's not working. And then because of that, maybe you sort of, you know, kind of push it a bit hard. I don't know what it is, but certainly I think it's a fine balance. You need to have enough confidence to really keep at it when it's going badly and not give up, because that's just it's a classic thing that it's easier to be disheartened and feel that something, you know, things are never going to turn out well. But at the same time, you need to have enough self-doubt that you feel that there's room for improvement, and you keep going back to something and not believe that the first attempt at something's good enough. And so, you know, I think if it's the same thing as what you're saying, and I think that there's this really, I think all creative people naturally have this sort of dichotomy between having a sense that they, you know, enjoy something and probably have some sort of propensity for doing it, but also have this, you know, nagging and sometimes paralyzing self-doubt, which can delay and sometimes completely disrupt you actually getting on and doing it.
Yeah, because it's a risky business, isn't it, being creative? There's no sort of mathematical equation to make something good. It's just sort of, I don't know if you ever feel like you're channeling something. I've talked to a lot of musicians about that. They feel like they're just sort of the conduit for something wonderful coming through them. Do you ever have that sort of feeling?
Certainly, because some of the most wonderful things are where you just don't remember any of the decisions you made when you were doing it. You look back and think, where did that come from? It is an amazing thing. And we can see it very much in musicians, where some days they'll just be so prolific. I think we talked about it, didn't we? And the sort of, we both know people who do that.
Yeah, it's amazing. What a wonderful feeling. I could only dream of it. So, talking of self-doubt there then, I've interviewed so many incredible people on this podcast, top of their game, naturally skilled, hardworking people who still have a sense of imposter syndrome. And I wonder if, because you didn't go to art school, you didn't study art, if you've ever experienced that imposter syndrome or had to deal with outside snobbery or judgment because of that, and if that's impacted you in any way.
I'm sure there's a bit of that. I think also some of it comes back to the school, and because probably a lot of it was the ADD meant that I was constantly forgetting to do homework or revise for exams, or and generally being the one told off and in the bottom half of the class all the way through. And it didn't occur to me till years after I left that, hang on, actually that was I was at a very academic school and those things were not necessarily always the most important things in life. And we as humans, we dwell on our, on criticism and on things that go wrong, because I'm guessing that's in some way part of our sort of survival instinct. It must have been important to really analyse things that seem wrong in case they were going to cause us more problems in the future, rather than be complacent about things. But it is something where there's this delicate balance of kind of having enough confidence to keep going at something where you don't really know where you're going, and almost inevitably the best work, the best creative work, is where you're not just following a template or what someone else has done, but you're exploring something new and you're having to take a risk that it might be a terrible idea. It often is. Certainly, in my case, I think all that's happened for me is I was probably lucky enough times early on with things going my way that now I can cope with the rejection when things go badly, because I feel this, over the course of a year, if it's, if I'm slightly up overall on things going well rather than badly, then that's a good year.
That's a nice way of looking at things. I really enjoy interviewing people, obviously, but one of the things that I really love is that I get to completely immerse myself in someone else's story for that moment in time, and also the lead up to it, because I'm looking into what I might assume about them and what I'm intrigued about and what I'm curious about. And I really enjoy learning other people's coping mechanisms, looking at their difficult times, looking at how they might have overcome adversity or really had hope in tough times, because I don't obsess about my own life as much in those moments. I can sort of let it slide and all of the worries dissipate somewhat, and I just really enjoy that sort of sense of escapism, but it's got a dual aspect of also me learning as well. And I wonder if you have a similar feeling, because obviously you're sat opposite someone for hours on end and you are somewhat, I guess, getting lost in that person, because you're not thinking about you, you're just thinking about them and what they're about and how to capture that. Do you experience that ever?
Certainly, that's the thing you're hoping will happen. I think also, again, partly by chance, I think, funny enough, when I started off really doing this was, immediately after having been, obviously quite ill, and it was quite well known. My dad was, at that time, was a politician, and he'd also been involved in sort of very public, kind of embarrassing events and that sort of thing. And so we had this thing of having quite publicly gone, and my sister had been very ill as well. She had a disability as a result of a brain tumour. And so I had this whole series of things which people knew about. And what happened was, I think that early stage where, people might be thinking, who's this, kind of 23-year-old guy asking me these questions? Suddenly they were, it was the opposite. It's like therapy for them. They'd immediately unburden themselves because, rightly or wrongly, having the sense that you've been through a near-death experience recently and all this very sort of public other stuff meant they felt very immediately able to trust me and the conversation, and even probably that I'd expected me to have a perspective which I was considerably more than I actually had at that point. But it was so. What, on the one hand, it breaks down barriers with people, and another thing was that you suddenly realize everyone's lives are more complicated than you realized. Because I think even then, and certainly now, there's this strange kind of, you know, pressure to give the impression that our lives are sort of blemish free and going smoothly. And I think social media's kind of exaggerated that even more. Made change. I did say slight change recently. I think since we're all going through this mad time, and we're all, none of us are able to do the things we would normally do. But I do think that, you know, this is an extra pressure for, you know, obviously it's been well documented, but for the a younger generation now, that they didn't know what it was like before all that, and didn't build up their confidence in the way they present things to the world at a time when, you know, there was always a bit of that pressure, but it wasn't this thing where you constantly expected to show how great things were all the time to everyone you knew.
Truth just breeds truth. Like, I find that, you know, if I'm interviewing someone or if I'm talking about a book or whatever, or even with friends, like, that's what I probably noticed more so. Like, when I've sat with a friend that I've not really gone to a deep place with, as soon as you start to offload or talk about something you feel extremely vulnerable about, they just feel that there's an opportunity for them to do it too. And perhaps we all want to do that. We all, you know, and you didn't have so much of a choice, I guess, back in the day with people knowing stuff about you. But if you are willing to kind of go there, other people are also alleviated. And that's really wonderful. Like, we all know we should talk more, but it's still, stuff gets in the way.
Mm. And yeah, and vulnerability is good. I think, you know, we act, when people are overly confident, we assume that some things have been completely thought through, and your instinct is to sort of pick holes in them. I'm thinking in terms of like how we share ideas creatively in other worlds. I do a lot of work at the moment where in the overlap between the kind of like art and technology, and it's so interesting seeing how there is, you know, obviously something's very different in those two worlds, but a lot that's very similar. And I think one of them is the sort of fragility of ideas, that really interesting ideas are very fragile because they're sort of still forming. And if you can, you know, often the sort of like successful processes and collaborations, whether it creatively or in the sort of tech world, especially in this overlap, are where people feel okay to sort of share things without it being made to feel ridiculous, if it is a ridiculous idea. Because sometimes the difference between something being inspired and being, you know, completely ridiculous is pretty wafer thin.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you've got to have a sort of atmosphere for all these things where people don't feel insecure and don't feel they'll be ridiculed for getting things wrong, or for, you know, kind of suggesting something which is complete, you know, they haven't noticed the sort of foolishness or the kind of mistakes in it.
That's so interesting. I love that, because that's something we all need to bear in mind, because we're all trying out new things all the time, but we're scared to often admit it or to say it out loud in case we are, I guess, essentially rejected. You know, perhaps that, you know, thought of possible rejection stops us having our greatest idea.
And there's then in that idea of rejection, there's a sort of an implied certainty that there's a right or wrong way of doing things, which is the opposite of creativity. You know, creativity is, you know, finding alternative ways for doing things. And yeah, you know, in fact, if it's not one of the established norms, that's a good thing. You know.
Yes. Yes, I totally agree. I really want to talk to you. I sort of want to backtrack slightly, but when we were talking about facial expression and reading other people, and this sort of plays into the whole thing about you having that sort of loose interview experience when you're chatting to someone, because of course part of your job is to have an understanding of this person and what they're about and how they might react facially, how they move, what they're feeling. How much of that comes from the eyes? Because again, you know, we've all had conversations in the last 5 years where someone's been on their iPhone although they're talking to us. I've probably done it to my husband today, quite frankly. But we're all multi-skilling, and it's sort of, the etiquette's a bit blurred these days. Like, is it okay to kind of take your phone to dinner and be looking at it a bit? You know, we're all kind of blurring the line slightly. And sometimes we do miss out on that intense, amazing eye contact that can be so powerful. And we've all felt it in like important moments in our lives. But when you're painting, what are you getting from that? Like, what can you sense from someone's eyes alone? We all know they're sort of the window to the soul, or whatever romantic notion you want to put to it, but they are such an important part of how we connect with another person. What are you getting from that?
Yeah, obviously, as a portraitist, I've always kind of, I think, had an instinct for this thing, but I never really understood it. It's only in recent years I've really kind of explored it a bit more. So yeah, on a fundamental level, one of the first decisions you make with a portrait is whether someone's going to be looking straight out or not. We're all doing these calls now where you kind of, where you're looking at the other person is a slightly off where the camera is, and therefore, you know, we're sort of near eye contact. I wonder if we do it too much, whether we're going to reset our brains to assume that's what we need more than the actual contact. And actually, so, I mean, it's a simple way with the paintings, when someone's making direct eye contact, for want of a better expression, it makes for a more powerful painting. It's more arresting. It's maybe a more immediate and often powerful sense of the personality. It's engaging, obviously. But it's also oddly more confrontational. When you go in, if there's a portrait where someone's looking out, it impacts on you in a different way. You feel you're forced to engage with it. Whereas if someone's looking into the picture some way, I've noticed in exhibitions that people will spend more time looking at those.
God, how funny. I've never thought of that. I've never thought of that, and I've probably done it.
And so there's some science behind this. There's when someone looks at you, it actually slows down your cognitive processes. You actually are less able to think about other things. Your brain literally, and you can see how that must have happened in an evolutionary way, because if you're out in the sort of savannas or the kind of like in the wilds or in like potentially hostile world, then someone suddenly being aware of your presence meant you had to make a decision whether it was okay to stick around or do a runner. And so that's one sort of like obvious way in which that eye contact is an important thing. There's other things like, you know, there's lie detection. You know, people stop breaking eye contact. That's often because, you know, the classic thing of looking shifty for people looking sort of sideways. But there's also that whole thing there. There's another funny thing, which I don't know if you've heard about the fact that when there's a sort of theory that when people are trying to recall, you ask them a question about, you know, where what happened on whatever day. If they look sideways, they're trying to remember. If they look up, they're making it up.
Oh, no way!
Yeah.
Oh, I'm writing that down.
I haven't found much to work out why that is. I don't know if it's because there's two sort of theories. One is that, you know, if you're looking sideways, you're looking for prompts in the real world that might remind you. And if you're looking up, you're trying to avoid that because you're trying to clear your head and then make something up quickly. Or there's another theory, which is the direction you look activates different parts of your brain. So you remember different things, or you're able to kind of, it kind of kicks off different thought processes.
Oh, I'm having some fun with this one. I've got some people to quiz. I need this lockdown to be over. I've got some people to quiz, and I'm going to be getting my notepad out. That is amazing. Because it's funny, I have noticed when I'm sat with someone in real life, and I'm, you know, when I write out these interviews, I've got a structure of where I want to go, and I'm not the sort of person that could wing it. I could never just roll up and think, I'll just chat about any old thing. I really like to have a bit of a story and a narrative. And that does mean that cognitively, I need to be really switched on to remember where the hell I'm going. If I do go off-piste, what happens next? And I love eye contact, but much more so when the person's answering, because I'm really locked in with what they're saying. And often when I'm thinking of the question, I do find myself flitting around the room and I'm like, God, it's so irritating. Why am I not just looking at them and engaging with them? And that's just really, you know, that's the final piece of the puzzle for me. I understand my own brain a bit better today after that. That's so fascinating because it is such an intense feeling, isn't it? Having eye contact. And maybe that again is something to do with just cognitively us, everything's slowing down. That must feel slightly unnerving on every level to us.
And it's you're absolutely right about that. And you take in so much visually all at once, but then you forget it much faster. If you hear something, obviously kind of visual communication sense is not based on time. So whereas kind of oral communication is, you know, the order which you say things is the order which you hear them. And that's, whereas when you look at something, you can choose to look at any part of what's in your field of view first and not look at other things. Or you can scan it. There's lots of different ways of doing it. But at the same time, as far as I know, the kind of like things that are, you know, in sort of text form or sound, words, conversation, those stay in your brain much longer than what you see. So, you know, it's a bit more sort of indelibly sort of printed, at least for a little while.
Does that lend itself to how you've got this beautiful style? We've talked a lot about style when we've been doing our portrait series because it's something I'm so interested in. I've not necessarily established my own style yet, but it's something that I think about a lot and I certainly experiment with. But your style now is so recognisable, and anyone that's an art fan or not will look at a picture and know that it's one of yours. And one of your sort of the defining parts of what you do is these lovely sections that aren't there, things that you leave the observer to, I guess, piece together themselves or you know, add something else that they feel is relevant. How do you make that decision as to what's important? You know, obviously you've got a lot of the faces usually very finely done, but there will be sections of hair missed out occasionally or sections of their body. What's the decision making around that?
I think it sort of happened gradually, really. I think because I, like you, I was experimenting a lot early on with very different kinds of ways of painting. And I found I was never kind of fully satisfied either with doing things which were completely abstract or gestural, but nor with things that were very, very finely realized and precise, especially not when they were to like the edge to edge of the picture was kind of rendered in the same way. And I think that sort of over time I've realized that that's also how I think, and I think how a lot of us sort of remember images isn't in minute detail the way a photograph sees things. I think we've been confused by photography in the 20th century because it's been such a brilliant and easy way of capturing things that we've started to mistakenly think that that's actually how we see. Because actually you don't take in everything that you're looking at in huge detail. You're quickly and selectively editing. And so I guess what I'm doing is representing an exaggerated version of that in how you could perhaps interpret what I was looking at that time, which I think works particularly well with portraits because we actually do tend to focus more on the face and the bits that are key to expressions, so the eyes and the mouth and certain peripheral details, you know, and as we were saying before, body language, certain clues to someone's sort of gender and age and how they're, what they're trying to say about themselves through how they're looking and standing and what they're wearing. But you don't need every part of it. You don't need everything that's in the background. You don't need, you know, you can certainly use elements in order to kind of like tell more of a story. And you might sort of put in a bit of jewelry or an object or something which tells a bit more of someone's story. But you don't want that to be more important than the things we'd naturally react to if we were there in front of someone, which is first and foremost, yeah, those key things. You know, who's this person? Are they a threat or a friend? What are they expecting next? What's going to happen? You know, all that sort of thing, which we get from a few little bits of information in our sort of visual field, you know, interpreted very precisely.
I think that's why I love portraits so much more than I love looking at a photograph of someone, because there is that element of you getting lost in it because you're piecing it together, you know, in your own way, and you're coming to a conclusion. It's not sort of presented to you. Here's the person, these are the ideas around them. You're allowed to, like, reading a book for me is more thrilling than watching a film, because again I'm piecing things together, and I find that much more exciting. Johnny, thank you so much. That was so lovely talking to you. I'm just so glad that we're getting to work together. Being such a fan, it's a huge deal for me that you're painting me, and I'm just mega excited. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's a great pleasure, and it's lovely having doing a painting of someone who's interested and knowledgeable about what I'm doing, because I think that makes for a kind of, I mean, puts a bit more pressure on me, but it also makes for a kind of a really, really interesting discussion as well. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Johnny. Now, look, if you're interested in seeing the finished portrait that Jonathan has done of me, you can see all the sittings and their final work right now. Just head to his website, jonathanyeo.com. There's a link in the show notes. Also, I popped a couple of those videos and the final portrait on my Instagram account as well. It is ridiculously amazing. Thank you, Johnny. It was an honour to take part in that. And you can discover many more fascinating speakers at the Happy Place Virtual Festival. It's still running. It's running till the 12th of July. It's completely free. You just sign up right now. Head to happyplacefestival.com. There's so much to see. Workshops, classes, talks, etc. A big thanks again to Johnny and to the producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And to you for listening. I couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much. Big love. See you soon.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.